Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Hi there. Welcome to I Should Be Writing, the podcast for wannabe fiction writers. I'm your host, Merle Lafferty, and this is like the third or fourth time I have tried to record this. I am not feeling confident with my recording lately. Ditch Stickers is easier because I have Matt to play off of. With I Should Be Writing, I'm like, okay, what am I going to talk about that I haven't talked about recently that's not too much whining? And the thing is, I don't really have a reason to whine, because things are going well, but here's a little secret to beginners. Your neuroses are your neuroses, and it doesn't matter how successful you get. They're going to be there. So you just have to learn to deal with them. Well, what's funny is this morning I suddenly have a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. So I'll split it into a couple of topics. First, I am about 63. Anyway, I'm over 60,000 words in my current project that I still can't talk about. And I'm on track to hit my deadline, and I'm feeling pretty good about it. Every once in a while, I think it seems to be at the 30,000 word mark, and then again at the 60,000 word mark, my brain starts to rebel and think, what else could I be working on that's more fun than this? And this is what everybody complains about, is like, I get halfway into a story, and then I want to write something else. And this is like, you know, grass is always greener. The other story that you're not writing is always more interesting than what you're working on now. That's because the story in your head is always perfect, and then you put it on the paper and it's crap. So you take the perfection, you put it on paper, it's crap, and then you look at the next perfection, and you're like, oh no, if I wrote that story, that one would be perfect. So I should just quit this crap and go to the perfect thing. It doesn't work that way. Your brain is just complaining about working and wants to go to the new and shiny. Resist that. But what today did do was made me start thinking about structure. I'm going to give some spoilers to A Song of Ice and Fire. If you watch the TV show or you read the books, these obviously are not spoilers, but if you're somehow behind, this is going to be a bit of a spoiler. Not too big, but a bit of one. What's always fascinated me, among other things, about this series is 20 years ago in the story, there was a thing called Robert's Rebellion, and lots of bad stuff happened. Robert rebelled, fought against the king and his forces, killed the prince. Jaime Lannister killed the king. And a lot of it was due to a woman. It's this whole Helen of Troy kind of thing, where the prince fell in love with a woman who Robert was in love with. And ostensibly he kidnapped her, kept her in a tower, and then she died. And Robert was fighting the rebellion to get her back. Now, everything that happens around that area, both the stuff that we know and the stuff that we don't know in the first couple of books or seasons, we never see that until a flashback. Like, I'm actually behind in the TV show, but I've heard there's a flashback of it. We don't see this action. We don't see the characters involved. We don't see their motivations. We just have people referencing it over and over again. But everything that happens in the book from here forward, from the first page of Game of Thrones, is largely due to Robert's Rebellion. So if you're George R. R. Martin and you're thinking, how am I going to structure this? Well, clearly the book starts when the action starts. So that's when there's the tournament and Rhaegar Targaryen does not give his favor to his wife, but he gives it to this other woman. So that's where the book should start. But he didn't do that. He saw that the things that happened beyond Robert's Rebellion, the cascading events, were more interesting. And the characters that he would come up with would be more interesting. You know, Robert and Ned are no longer young, hothead warriors. They're now older people in their own keeps with their families and having to deal with children who will soon go through what they went through with the fighting and everything. So he decided to take that event and make it be a point in the story where that everyone refers to. And because that people are referring to it in different points of view, you're not exactly sure what happened. So I have a book idea I've been kicking around for a couple of years. And it starts when there's an invasion and these two kids and this old woman escape through the mountains and bad things happen and they end up in a town far outside the mountains. And the kids have to grow up there. And I was going to tell their story from the day there's the invasion to the kids being adults in the cities and what happens due to that invasion. And I sort of had an epiphany today saying, no, I think the story starts when there's a new threat, a new conflict, a new person connected to that incident 15, 20 years ago. And our characters who've tried to make their lives as best as they can have to address it again. And so you have, they're settled in their lives. They pretty much hate each other. But something happens to where they're the only two who know how to deal with it. So they have to unite and figure out what's going on because of what happened many years ago when they were children. And I realized that we talk about starting stories the day that something changes for somebody. Or starting stories when someone comes to town or someone leaves town. Or starting stories in media res. Is that how you pronounce it? I'm not sure. But those are all simplified. How do you know what changes in your character's life? For example, the little girl wakes up and her town is invaded and she escapes with an old woman and her friend. Is the day the town's invaded, is that the beginning of the story? Because that's where her life changed. Or is it much later when she thinks she's completely going to starve to death and someone takes pity on her and gives her a job? Is that when her life changes and that when the story starts? Or does the story start when she sees something in a market and realizes that what she left behind is not necessarily dead? Is that when the life changes and the story starts? So people's lives change in many different stages. So if you're kicking around an idea, decide which one makes the most sense. Write out a couple of scenes. Does a scene sound better if it's in a flashback? Does a scene seem like it would be better if a whole bunch of people were remembering it slightly differently? You don't know until you write it out. Similarly, with Star Wars, we have Luke's story, but everything that happens in Star Wars happened because of everything that happened to Anakin. But we didn't get those stories right away. We got Luke's story, which is the mentor is old. He's done with adventuring. The kid is learning that the galaxy is a lot bigger than he thought. And seeing as everybody has spaceships, they already know the galaxy is pretty big. So I'm not here to discuss all the different kinds of structures. Just, it's really important and people don't really talk about it a lot. Because yes, you need characters, you need conflict. Maybe you know exactly what story you want to tell because you want to tell the story of X happening. But you could think about it a little bit and think, well, do I want to tell what happens when X happened? Or do I want to tell the cascading results of X happening? So think about that. Your story, if your story's stalled, maybe you have the right setting, the right characters, and the right conflict, but the wrong structure or the wrong timeline. So the second thing I was going to talk about today is bad habits. And I reveal my mistakes, my foibles, my struggles on this podcast, mainly so you guys will know that you're not alone. If you think that, you know, a pro writer doesn't procrastinate, or a pro writer doesn't play video games, or a pro writer doesn't hate every word they write, it's not true. At least it's not true in my case. But this is so embarrassing, it's hard for me to articulate it, but it is an epiphany, and I've had it, and it will change my life for the better, but it's still embarrassing. I started writing for money in 2001, when I started writing for RPGs. Only this week have I discovered that if I just get up, get a glass of water, and sit down to write, I can get 1,600 words before 8:30 when I have to drive my kid to school. And it's easy. And I've told people you have to find the right time of day that's perfect for you to write. And I've told people you can get up earlier and put your writing in there. And you know, I've given this advice, but I've always let myself be distracted. The dogs distract me. Housework distracts me. When my kid was younger, I tried to get up earlier to write. But if she heard me moving around, well, it was time to get up. And so she would get up. But she's a teenager and that doesn't happen anymore. I'm embarrassed. I really am. But a couple of times this week I've done it and it's worked great. Now my next problem is trying to fit in exercise because I'm running again. And which is great, except it is mid-May in the U.S. South, which means we will very easily start getting into the 90-degree days. And if I go running any time before 10 a.m., that could be very bad for my health. I see people running on their lunch breaks, and I want to run after them with like a bottle of water and a blanket soaked in ice water and just say, stop, stop, please, you'll die. But you know, you have to fix your life one habit at a time. You can't do a whole bunch of stuff because you'll fail. So right now, the habit I'm trying to make is getting up and writing. And I am both thrilled and mortified that it's taken me so damn long to figure this out. Because I was always somebody who would procrastinate. I would think, I can't write until the little chores are done. Because it feels like, you know, cleaning off your workspace. Like, I can't write when I know that there's X to do or Y to do or Z to do. And then I do those things and either it fully distracts me from writing and I don't write, or it tires me out, or it eats up the whole day. But now I know if I do the eat the frog mentality, which is take care of the biggest, most important thing you have to do. Actually, I think eat the frog is do the worst thing you have to do, which some days writing is the worst thing I have to do. But still, if you tackle the most important thing first, then you can move on to other things. Now, I know that your life is different from mine. You may have a day job, you may have a night job, you may have a family, you may have school, and so this specific thing may not work for you. But all I'm saying is be open to trying things in different times. You may find that you're a better late night writer. You may find that you're a good binge writer on the weekend. You may find that getting up early and writing is not that bad. It's hard to say. But I want to get a couple of questions in before I stop. Oh, and while I'm looking for this, I will tell you, the Nebulas are this weekend and I'm going to the Nebula Conference at 30 tomorrow morning, which means I'll be landing in Pittsburgh around 10:30. If I don't go straight to bed, I'll be around the conference. And hope to see people. I apologize if I mispronounce this name. It's Swedish. It's Malin or Malin. Writes about having ADHD and struggling with editing. The writing part wasn't hard. I could see the number of words increasing and that made it easier. But the editing part is so difficult. I've been trying to edit for a year now and I just can't seem to make myself do it. Do I experience this? And if so, how do I tackle it? I hate editing. But it's necessary, so I can't really not do it. But here's how I do it. First, I read through everything and I make notes. I make notes that this needs more description, or this needs to be fixed, or this is a continuity error, or later in the book I say this doesn't work at all, which is also a continuity error, sorry. And then I start going through and fixing things. One thing that you said that really stuck out to me is this fact that writing wasn't hard because you could see the number of words increasing and that made it easier. I'd say you should open up a fresh document. Take a hunk of words or a chapter, some set piece of work, and paste that into the new document. And that's your editing for the day. So when you're done with the editing for the day, you can say, hey, I'm 3,000 words into my new book, edited. And that's great. That's about my only advice. Rachel asks, I'm a new listener. You mentioned earlier in 2017 that you stopped writing for 10 years. Can I ask why? Can I ask how you managed to get back into it? Yes, this is something I talk about, no problem, frequently. When I left college, I got my English degree. I took a lot of creative writing classes. And for some reason, I psyched myself out and believed that I could not get any better. I was entering the corporate world. I was trying to make a living. I was falling in love, found my husband, got married. And I always told myself I would be a writer, but I never did it. Thought about it all the time. I got writing books. I let any writing advice that did not fit my life, I let that psych me out. Ray Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing really messed me up. I know a lot of people love it, but there was like one phrase in there that really, really messed me up. I basically let myself psych myself out and let everything around me psych myself out. There was a really good, really, really good writer in my creative writing class by the name of Dan Coyce. I say his name because he writes for Slate now and does awesome things. So I was right to be intimidated by him. He thinks it's hysterical because I should not have been, and I should not have been intimidated. He's a very good writer, and I respect that. But I saw Dan's skill, and I thought, well, I'll never be that good. So why try? And I really just stopped writing for 10 years. And I started again when I got laid off from my job in 2001 and realized, well, why not start now? You have the time. The economy's not great. I kept looking for a job, but I also started writing. I also lucked out that a friend of mine had just left White Wolf Publishing to go to video game design. And so he knew a lot of people at White Wolf, and he looked at some of my stuff and thought I would be a good fit for RPGs, so he recommended me. So it was part networking and finding somebody who believed in me, another writer. So my friend Richard Dansky introduced me to White Wolf and helped me get started on my path. And one reason I do this podcast is to tell people the only person you're competing against is yourself. You only want to be as good as or better than you were yesterday. Because the minute you focus on somebody else's career, you're going to find yourself lacking. You're going to find some way to find yourself lacking. And even if they would look at you and think something wonderful about you and find themselves lacking, it's just human nature. And so that's why I quit, and that's why I do this podcast, to tell people don't quit. And remember that writing is just like using a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger you get. You don't hit a wall and never get any better. So the only way to fail is to stop. So good luck and get to work on it. I believe in you. Adam writes a question that's similar to what I just talked about, which is he's got a rigid schedule and higher priorities in his life, and he wants to know how to find time to write. You need to do a time audit. You need to look at your schedule And you're going to see your family. You're going to see your classes or your job or your commute. But that part's obvious. Are you going to see the time you spend on a tablet game? Are you going to see your TV usage, your video game usage? Are you going to see the weekly trip out to have a beer with your friends? That is all time that you could use writing. And I'm not saying kill your downtime. Everybody needs relaxation. Everybody needs downtime. But you have to set priorities when, if you want to do this. One of my favorite anecdotes is Chuck Palahniuk writing Fight Club when he worked at a gas station. The funny thing is, Fight Club reads like someone wrote it in 5-minute bursts at a gas station, but it works for him. It worked for the book, but he wanted to write, so he found time whenever he could. Whenever you have a downtime and you think, I'm going to watch a TV show or play games on my tablet or something, think to yourself, if I choose, if I'm going to write, I can write or I can watch this TV show. And maybe I will choose the TV show, but it's going to be a conscious decision that I'm choosing the TV show and I'm choosing not to write. And that will start to let you know where your priorities are. Second question is networking. Tips for introverts who don't normally reach out to others. I feel like I should have something present before I start. How much should I have before I show agents, editors, peers before delving in? Well, you're talking about a lot of different things here. When I think of networking, I think of just meeting people and letting people know that you exist and you might be a pleasant person to work with in the future. It's like putting drops in a bucket and it doesn't feel like it does any good, but it does. I like to think that I write for book burners right now, partly because I'm a good writer, but also because I went tiara shopping with Max Gladstone in 2013. In fact, Max and I were nominated for the same award, or was it 2014? Anyway, we were nominated for the same award, and we decided that everybody should get tiaras, because the winner got a diadem, which is a round circlet that goes over your head. But there was a mall nearby. We thought, hey, we're going to go buy tiaras for everybody who's nominated. And it was fun. We went out, we bonded. And when it came time for Max to build a team to write book burners, because we'd made friends by, you know, buying tiaras together, you know, that is not because he doesn't say, I'm pretty sure anyway, hey, she was fun to buy tiaras with. But we connected, we bonded, we had fun, we remembered each other, we talked at cons after that. Did networking by buying TRs work out for me? Yes. It's partly networking. It's partly just making friends, which I understand is takes a little bit more extroversion than introversion. If you're going to a convention and you don't have anything at all to show people, that's fine. Have a goal. Have a goal of what you want to achieve from the convention, what you want to achieve by networking. Meaning, do you want to meet editors? Do you want to meet agents? Do you want to meet other authors? Do you want to get advice from other authors? So have your goal and put a challenge up for yourself. Say, I'm going to meet two people that I admire, not just like random people who are also attending the convention. And choose your panel list or plan your book signings. You could go to book signings and meet people, either after the panel or at a signing or at the bar. Introduce yourself. Say you admire their work. Say you're a writer. If they're open to talking, strike up a conversation. If you are actively looking for an agent or looking to sell directly to an editor, you're going to want to do different. You're going to want to do research of what agents to talk to, which means you have to see your favorite books, who represents those authors, and then find out where they're going to appear at conferences. Maybe they will have like a speed dating thing where you get to pitch your stuff to a lot of agents, which will make you talk to people. Or you could, again, talk to the agent after a panel or at the bar or something. And the way to approach an agent in this case, if you're hunting for an agent, is not to say, here's my manuscript, tell me what you think. It's, again, strike up a conversation. If you like something their clients did, tell them, because they love to hear that. You're telling them that they're doing their job well, and when you say, I love this book by your client. If you strike up a conversation with them, they are probably going to know that you are a writer looking for an agent. So they may ask you if you're a writer, if you're working on something. If they don't ask you, you can end your conversation with, are you accepting submissions now? And then if they say yes, then go home and put in your cover letter, we met at X convention. I was the one who asked you about this person's books. And then put put your submission together. A couple of things. Again, don't take a paper copy and shove it at them. Don't take a thumb drive and shove it at them. Don't say, hey, you rejected my last book. Don't open with that. That's weird. And people do it. I don't understand how people do it. I think they just want to put people on the spot. I don't know. Don't put yourself down. Don't say, I don't know if it's ready yet, blah, blah, blah. Just say, you know, that's not your decision. Yes, you need to know when your book is polished and ready to go. But really, whether it's ready for publication or not is not your decision. So don't self-reject. If you're talking about social media, Matt and I talk about this a lot on my other podcast, Ditch Diggers. It's just like meeting anybody else on social media. Follow a bunch of people in book Twitter. Follow agents. And then the agents will be talking about their clients, but they'll also be talking about what they like, what they're doing. And you can respond to them and say, hey, I saw that movie too, and it was great. Or I didn't know you were into that genre of book because you don't represent it. And then you can ask them questions about it. It's just being polite and talking to people. And I know that, for example, the writer Adam Christopher got his foot in the door with Angry Robot through Twitter because he was talking to one of the editors on Twitter. My friend Ursula got a editor interested in her book by just making a joke about it on Twitter, and an editor saw it. You don't have to be completely gregarious. I think I used that word right. But, you know, if you're going to be out in public, have a plan, have a goal of who to meet. And it doesn't have to be a lot of people. It can just be a couple. And then you can start feeling on how to do this. And if you're doing it online, then just chat with people. Like you just chat with anybody who started talking about horses or astronomy or football. Oh, but don't pitch your stuff to readers. Don't pitch your stuff to editors or agents if you're not ready. Just work on meeting people and being friendly. But don't pitch if you're not ready, because if they actually ask for it and you don't have anything to give them, or you cobble something together and send them something crappy, it's going to be bad. Shoshana asks, I've heard a lot of people talk about beta readers for the first draft. If there's a beta reader, this begs the question, what then is an alpha reader? I don't think alpha readers exist. I believe the beta actually refers to the state of the manuscript, not the second reader of the book. So when your draft is in beta phase, and that means you've written the book and gone through an editing pass and feel good about it, that's when you hand it to a beta reader. So some people may have alpha readers, but I think mainly it's beta means that stage in the manuscript, not the stage of readers that you get. If somebody listening has alpha readers, please tell me, because it's not something I have experience with. Kyle asks, I've been listening to a lot of interviews with writers, and they all seem to be talking about story beats. What are story beats? How do I know if I have enough of them? Or perhaps the number's not important, but what is inside the beats? How do I know if I'm doing story beats right? Story beats are places in the plot that change. You know, there's the, to use the Joseph Campbell Western kind of hero's journey, you've got, there's the call to adventure beat. There's the part of the story where everything goes wrong. There's the part of the story where the hero looks deep within themselves or finds a way to beat the villain and rises anew and comes back. There's the denouement. There's the climax. There's the, in a romance, there's the first kiss. Those are all story beats. To learn more about story beats, I'd say the best book out there is called Save the Cat by Blake Snyder. And it's more talking about screenplays, but it's still talking about story. Story beats are what help raise the tension. So something happens and it's resolved. Something else happens and then it's resolved. And resolved doesn't mean it goes well. It could mean it goes terribly. But yeah, check out Save the Cat. Story beats are, if you've heard of the hero's journey, that's broken into story beats. If you read Save the Cat, that tells you the beats of a screenplay. So that's what that means. Joel writes, I have 4 point of view characters and I'm about 40,000 words into my book. One of the points of view is the antagonist, but I don't see that happen very often in a book. So am I doing something wrong? No, you're not doing anything wrong. The interesting thing about point of view is it when you get inside a character's head, you immediately start to feel sympathy for them because they stop being, you know, to use a cardboard cutout phrase, pure evil, and they start being a person. To go back to A Song of Ice and Fire, a really good example of this is when Jaime Lannister gets his own point of view. He's still a wretched human being, but he is a lot more sympathetic once you get inside his head and learn his point of view. Martin also gives Cersei a point of view. She is less sympathetic, but still kind of sympathetic once you see inside her head. I think typically with stories, you have person tries to do something, antagonist works against them. And part of what surprises the reader is what the antagonist has in store for the hero and what the hero does to counter it. So if the reader knows everything the antagonist is about to do, it might stop some of the tension in the book. So maybe don't telegraph all of that, but also remember that the antagonist is not the evil person. The antagonist is the person trying to stop the hero from doing what they're doing. One of my favorite examples recently is Stranger Things, which has, yes, it's got the antagonist of the monster and the evil government, but every subgroup of characters are each other's antagonists because they're all trying to solve the mystery, figure out what's happened, whatever, on their own, and not take help from the other groups. And so they're kind of, you know, like the mom doesn't want the kids out doing danger. She wants them at home and safe so more kids don't go missing. So they don't want the kids out there trying to figure out what's going on. And I don't know if I've ever seen a story so obviously have many groups of people all working toward the same goal, but not working together until maybe the very end. And I found that really interesting. It brought in a new idea of protagonist versus antagonist to me. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with having your antagonist have a point of view. It makes them more human. It makes them more relatable and a better character. Just make sure you don't give away every single thing that's going to happen in the story by giving their point of view. And that's it for the feedback. This lasted a lot longer than I expected it to. Yeah, had to get through some stuff. I want to talk next about setting, and I want to talk a little bit more about point of view, but we'll do that in a later podcast because I've got a lot here, and I want to get it up before the Nebulas this weekend. If you are a listener and you are at the Nebulas this weekend, please come by and say hi. I would love to see you because I like meeting listeners, but I also really like to be distracted from things that are stressing me out, such as the Nebula Awards, where I am planning to lose with glory. Because if I expect to win, I'll be horribly disappointed. So, yay, losing nebulas. And if you want to reach me, I can be found at mightymert@gmail.com. You can see the blog and show notes at merverse.com. I'm on Twitter at mightymer, but I'm trying to take a little bit of a mental health break again. I've got a book to finish, and every once in a while, my mental health goes, hey, I'm mostly stable, until I look at social media or the news a lot, and then I plummet. And I've been feeling a little bit like that lately. So I'm on Twitter sometimes. My award-nominated book, Six Wakes, is still available. It's a clone murder mystery in space. The book that is a companion to this podcast called I Should Be Writing is also available, I believe, worldwide in English-speaking territories, ebook and physical book. And my collaborative project, Book Burners, which is a serial ensemble cast of people fighting magical books that spring up in the world. Season 4 starts next month, which I can't believe, but if you want to learn more about that, you can go to serialbox.com, that's S-E-R-I-A-L, and you can get the first season and learn all about that, and then download subsequent seasons, and then catch up to us in Season 4. And also, you can support this show on Patreon, patreon.com/mightymer. At the $5 and up level, we have a Discord invite only that people show up and they do writing sprints, they talk about writing, talk about conventions. So it turns out to be a pretty fun place. Patreon.com/mightymer. And that is it. Go forth and put words down because you should be writing. Remember, you can support the show at patreon.com/mightymer. I Should Be Writing theme music provided by John Anilio. You can find more about him at johnanilio.com. This podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license.